Hello and welcome to Young Science Today with me, Andrew Dennison.
And me, Jessica Knott.
In today's programme, we're going to have a couple of discussions. We're going to have one about the genetically modified foods and the rising food prices. We're going to have another one about the portrayal of science in the media as well.
Also joining us today is our Young Researcher of the Week, John Armand from the University of Warwick. So over to him to tell us about his research. Hi, John.
Thank you. A key component of our body is protein. There are thousands of different kinds of proteins fulfilling all kinds of roles, for example, as molecular machines. Now, scientists have studied proteins in depth for a long time, both biochemically and looking at their 3D shapes. What has not been well studied is their mechanical properties, how strong they are, how stretchy they are, and whether they can pull back.
Okay, John. I've heard some stuff in the press about things like silk being exceptionally strong proteins. Are they all like this?
Not at all. Some proteins, as you say, like the silk proteins, are extremely strong, whereas others are much softer. And indeed, some act like machines and move in well-defined ways. But if we learn more about their motion in this kind of way, that knowledge helps us to understand where they can go wrong in certain diseases, for example.
Okay, so what sorts of techniques do you use to study the proteins?
I use atomic force microscopy. What this consists of is a really tiny lever made out of silicon with a sharp tip, similar to an old record player stylus, but much smaller. My protein is attached to this lever and a fixed surface, and then we just pull on it and stretch the protein. And by shining a laser off the lever, we can determine how much it's bending and therefore how much force the protein is absorbing.
Oh, wow, that's excellent.
Okay, also joining us today is Alistair Irvine, science editor at the Daily Mirror.
Good afternoon.
So, Alistair, you're in the business of displaying science in the media to the public. How do you go about this normally?
First of all, can I say I thought John's research, the way he put it, is very interesting. It seems like he's doing some nice stuff there.
Thanks.
I think, generally speaking, one of the most important things about communicating science is just to be able to know your audience, you know, and you have to be able to, pitch it at the right level. That's always going to be a challenge because you have to be aware of what the readership, for example, in the newspapers will depend on, what kind of newspaper it is and that sort of thing.
Okay, so now we will break and go to our pick of the week's science news. A controversial technique for identifying crime suspects through their DNA has just been approved for use in the criminal justice system. The technique, called low copy number DNA testing, was discredited when the Omaha bombing trial collapsed. Now, though, lawmakers say the technique is fit for purpose. Our crime correspondent, Hayley Powell, has been investigating. Her report begins with the technique's inventor, Professor Brian Caddy.
Sample from the scene of investigation, and then we take it into the lab and we compare this piece of genetic information with genetic information of suspects.
So how does this actually differ from techniques that are already currently being used?
Yeah, the advantage of this technique is that it uses a miniature amount of sample, and also the analysis can be done quicker compared to the conventional techniques.
So exactly how small are the samples we're talking about?
We are talking about 1 trillion of a gram is enough for our investigations.
So there has been some criticism of this technique, that since it's such small samples that practically anyone that had been in the area would have left traces of their DNA around and may get implicated.
No, there is no danger at all, because as provided that the sample is obtained in a way that contamination from different people is eliminated, then the technique is selective and specific enough to discriminate between closely related suspects.
Despite scientists' reassurances, critics feel the technique could lead to wrongful convictions, We spoke to Professor Alan Jameson about his concerns.
It cannot be easily transferred from the lab bench to the courtroom, and that the sensitivity of this technique is such that the small amount of DNA could merely come from contamination either at the crime scene, circumstantial blowing in of DNA, or simply contamination in the police laboratories.
What kind of measures do you believe need to be put in place to make it a more reliable technique?
The main problems that exist are contamination, and I think that we need to have a national or, if possible, international standard for cleanliness and for the processing of these DNA samples.
In light of these criticisms, we spoke to the forensic science regulator backing the proposal.
We have set up national training for police forensic teams so that they know how to behave at criminal scenes, how to collect DNA properly without contaminating it. And also the DNA kits we use at the crime scene are now produced so that they are completely DNA free.
Hopefully, the control measures will be sufficient to ensure that this powerful tool is not misused.
Thank you, Hayley, for that report. So, what do you think of our favourite science report this week then, Alistair?
Yeah, I think that was quite interesting. About the whole look up of DNA and the whole debate about how reliable it is and whether it should be used in court.
And what about you, John?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting and well presented. This is an example of a good news report about some new science technology, but I think it's worth mentioning that sometimes sensationalisation can happen, where a news reporter will just take what has been shown as a new discovery and make it into a calamitous world disaster to sell papers. I think this is a real problem.
Well, I think in reality, going back to what I said about knowing your audience, I think to some extent the audience that you might have for this show, for example, might be quite different from the one of the newspapers that I sell. I work in a very sort of competitive environment, and it's in some ways, although it's a bit of a cliche, I think it's actually often important to sensationalise your stories in order to get people to actually, you know, look at them and read them in order to get the it's out there, if you know what I mean. And the reality is, like it or not, that this often means that you will go with the figures that do sensationalise it to some extent. But in the end of the day, we're still like portraying the figures that we are given by the scientists. We're not really misleading in that sense.
So the type of stories that you're talking about, the sensationalisation, they're often public health and environmental issues. How important do you think it is that fundamental researchers like John here get their science out to the public?
I think it is very important to do that. I think as well as a journalist, can often be, especially with the daily newspapers, you can often be run into very tight schedules and stuff. So it's very important when they communicate their science to us that it's done in a very sort of succinct manner. And rather than just bombarding us with figures, they actually sort of put it all in context.
I think it's worth remembering, though, that not people aren't stupid. You know, if a scientific discovery is interesting and new, people will find it interesting. You know, you don't have to dumb down everything just to make it acceptable to the public.
Okay, so I think basically the science and media need to talk to each other a bit more communication.
Perhaps, yes.
Okay.
So now we go on to our featured discussion on genetically modified foods. Would you like to introduce our guests?
I would indeed. Here today are fine panellists, Daniel Nicolaou and Andrea Lane. Daniel is from UCL and Andrea is from the Chemical Biology Centre of Imperial College. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Good to be here this evening. Thanks.
Okay, so basically, for those of you that don't know, GM plants have basically just had genes added or modified in the lab to make them perform in a specific way. This modification can, for example, produce crop that can grow more favourably in poorer soils, such as those in Africa. Only GM can do this compared to conventional crossbreeding. So basically, we want to ask our panellists, is this true? Is GM the way forward for poorer countries in this basically a really bad food crisis at the moment?
Well, you know, I think that it's not a problem of production of food. You, in a lot of industrial countries, you have large surplus of things like grains, staple foods. It's more a problem of logistics. If we could get that to Africa where people are hungry, problem solved. Then we wouldn't have to go for GM foods. It's not a problem of making more food. It's a problem of getting to the right places.
I can understand that now, but in the future, with the population growth, I think GM food will able to solve this problem for the long-term future rather than the immediate future. I can understand the logistics of moving food.
Well, that's a fairly controversial statement, because there are studies that say that the yield of a GM-modified crop are not all that much bigger. And the other thing that you've got to think about is that any sort of weeds or insects, they might be slowly modified through cross-pollination and cross-breeding of insects or something like that, that they also get more resistant. So,
on your first point, though, that's not the only advantage of GM food. I mean, the biggest point, which our presenter Jess has highlighted, is the fact that the GM crops can be grown on poor soil, which means there is extra land to grow more crops. And the other advantages of GM crops are the fact that you can actually incorporate genes that would otherwise eliminate pesticides and herbicides, which a lot of people can understand would not like to use in the production of their food. And another good point is that we can incorporate important things such as vitamin A. I mean, there is a GM crop, rice, where they've incorporated the beta-carotene gene, which eventually is converted to vitamin A.
That is one of my particular favorites, because you could also just eat carrots, couldn't you? I mean, why eat rice that has the same thing as carrots in it and then say it's a good thing?
But then you would have...
You could have a more varied diet and solve the problem the same way.
But that's the problem at the moment, that, you know, we are still unable to transport these carrots to the people needing them, whereas we are able to do that with rice in one go. It's solving two birds with one stone.
This is true, but we might be making country dependent of our transports, where we could also teach them to
at the same time, grow carrots. At the same time as we're wondering about the transport of these carrots and whether these carrots are going to get put into the rice.
Oh, yes.
Like I myself, I'm quite worried about these GM crops and whether I really want to eat them. It's not been tested that long, really, whereas I know that people have been eating apples for thousands of years.
This is true. I mean, it's a technique that was developed 15 years ago? So any long-time study is going to be 15 years, and that's not really terribly long. So it's really difficult to predict long-term effects of this, and we just don't know. And it seems a pretty big experiment with, you know, all of humanity.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure this is part of the reason why there was such a big backlash a few years ago over this Frankenfoods thing.
Frankenfoods indeed. And the benefits, well, arguable.
Oh, no, there are many benefits, and I certainly will argue for this. I think the biggest problem is the fact that many countries that truly do need GM food, particularly in Africa, have laws to ban GM foods, even though that many of their people are actually starving. I mean, only South Africa actually has commercialized any GM crops.
I don't know the details of why these countries are banning them, but I mean, part of the problem is that it's not public sort of knowledge or research that has developed these foods, but it belongs to large corporations, so they have an overhead for development costs. They own the patents. They're going to make this more expensive.
A lot of these countries are actually, and there are some countries out there that are actually performing their own GM trials without any aid of any corporate companies.
Well, another thing that I think that people kind of don't consider quite enough is the fact that it's going to have on sort of a ecosystem that you plant these crops into. If, for instance, it's a GM plant that is more resistant against pesticides, then all sorts of weeds will stop living. And this, in turn, will have the fact that animals that live off weeds, for instance, butterflies, which are wonderful animals, they might all start dying, and that's terrible.
I can understand that. But however, there was a report called the Bright Project, which actually concluded that with the crops that they had, the GM crops that they had studied, that they were no more harmful than any other conventional plant.
I assume this was a long-term study of 2 years?
No, it was actually over 5 years. And if they found that over 5 years, with very important crops, that there are actually no harmful effects to the plants, to the competing plants, then I do feel that the benefits certainly outweigh any potential risks, either from long-term or from any damage to a butterfly.
Being this hasty is pretty brave.
So you'd say there's no threat to biodiversity from GM foods, then?
There may be potential effects. However, the genetic changes for the plants that we are actually being produced, I don't see a catastrophic event that sometimes the media may portray, or that people
I agree with you. It's not catastrophic. It's going to be long and dragging, and it's going to change, you know, the landscape around us. It's going to change weeds.
Andrea,
it's an important part.
Do you think that the benefits in Africa outweigh the disadvantages?
No, when, I think that,
as Daniel made the point earlier, so many people are starving there.
Well,
surely
it's a problem that can be solved otherwise. The yield that you get is not that much greater, and you can also grow other crops in Africa. It's just that certain large companies have an interest to push these crops because they're not that popular, so they're desperate down in Africa, and that's why it's kind of a subject. But I think that conventional crops could be just as successful.
Daniel, how would you respond
to
this?
A necessity.
The amount of food that you can produce from GM crops, admittedly that the yield compared to the conventional techniques in a fertile soil may not be truly advantageous to convert to GM for yield purposes. But when you consider the fact that there are a great deal amount of soil out there that would not normally produce any crops. And with GM, you potentially have this mass area where you can produce a great deal more crops. So actually, your overall abundance of food will increase dramatically. And especially now when you're having competing problems with biofuels, where they're actually taking a great deal of agricultural land away from potential food sources.
I quite agree. This is definitely a problem. I mean, solving the energy crisis with biofuels is something that I'm not quite sure I agree with.
No, I completely disagree.
This biofuels thing is it's been portrayed as partially responsible for the rise in food prices that we've seen in this country. So bringing the debate close to home, what advantages would GM food have for a country like Britain, where we do not have this problem with bad soils? We're a very fertile country, and
I think the biggest benefit from using the GM crops worldwide would be to help alleviate the demand of food from China and India. I mean, their growth in terms of economy is so vast, and that has been a major contributor to the growth or the increase in the prices of staple crops.
I'm not so sure. I disagree.
Okay, guys, I think we're going to have to agree to disagree.
Okay, so thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
Thank you, Andrea.
My pleasure. It's been good being here.
It's a really interesting debate there.
Yeah, I mean, you've both given us a lot of things to think about there. I hope if anyone listening to this feels strongly about the way they feel these issues today, would you like to email us at youngsciencetoday@bbc.co.uk?
And join us next week for intellectual discussion on the new Large Hadron Collider in Oxfordshire. Thanks for listening. Okay.